Welcome to the AKC Podcast, an audio resource for the King's community following the Associateship of King's College programme. The AKC is an inclusive, research-led programme of lectures which explore diverse religious and cultural perspectives. For more information, visit kcl.ac.uk/AKC. Lecture resources and further reading links for this lecture are available on the AKC Keats area.
This AKC series explores Indian philosophies in all their diversity. And the title of my talk today is Between Past and Future, Muslim Political Philosophy in Colonial India. And before I begin, I just wanted to sort of note that when I refer to colonial India, I'm really referring to a period of about 200 or so years from the middle of the 18th century until 1947, when, as some of you may already know, two independent post-colonial nation-states emerged out of a violent and tumultuous partition. Those two states were India and Pakistan, which at the time included both East and West Pakistan. And in 1971, after a civil war, the subcontinent was, as it were, partitioned a third time, leading to the kind of breakup of East and West Pakistan into Bangladesh and Pakistan, respectively, which are the nation states that we have today. Okay. But of course, we're talking about, as it were, a kind of undivided Indian context, all right? And as a result of this sort of complex political history that has unfolded over the last 75 years or so, when scholars went to study the history of Muslim political philosophy in colonial India, the topic of my talk today, they were mostly interested in recovering ideas about nationalism and about religious difference, particularly kind of Muslim nationalism and arguments centered on religious identity, partly as a way of making sense of the political present, right? And the kind of political violence that continues to shape the present. India, of course, was and still is home to the world's largest Muslim minority. And debates around what led to the partition of 1947 or what led to the emergence of Bangladesh continue to dominate the study of Muslim thought in South Asia. But while sort of questions of nationalism and religious difference were certainly a crucial part of the story, and one cannot really visit that history without thinking about these questions, it's important to also consider that Muslims in colonial India were also thinking about a number of different issues, right, alongside the question of nationhood. And the one I want to focus on today is time, which is, of course, a theme that is engaged with by a number of different philosophical traditions within and beyond India. And more specifically, I want to talk about how Muslim philosophers in colonial India thought about the relationship of the present, the now, vis-a-vis the past on the one hand and the future on the other. So time is of course a sort of ambiguous theme, but specifically the relationship of the present to the past and the future. That's going to be the subject of my talk today. And I'd like to begin by looking a bit more closely at the painting you see on the screen. So this painting was completed in 1902 during what we might call the kind of height of colonial rule in India by a painter named Abanindranath Tagore, who was actually the nephew of Rabindranath Tagore, who you heard about a couple weeks ago, I think. So quite an artistically inclined family. And the painting is called The Passing of Shah Jahan, and it's painted in the kind of miniature tradition, what is often called the miniature tradition, which has its sort of roots in Persian visual art. And it depicts a scene in which the fifth Mughal emperor, Shah Jahan, who lived during the 17th century, is on his deathbed, gazing longingly at the Taj Mahal in the distance. Some of you may know that the Taj Mahal is a grand marble mausoleum that he had constructed to house the tomb of his wife, Mumtaz Mahal. So Shah Jahan, as I said, was the fifth Mughal emperor, and the Mughals were a Muslim dynasty that ruled over a large part of the Indian subcontinent for several hundred years, from the beginning of the 16th century until the middle of the 19th. And its rulers were usually depicted with much grandeur and vibrancy and intricacy in visual art. So on the left is an image of Shah Jahan from the 17th century, looking quite opulent, with a golden halo gesturing at the kind of divine grace that the artist thought sanctioned his rule. You can even see a few angels or cherubs at the top there who are sort of showering the emperor with jewels and light. So this is a very different kind of image from Tagore's depiction on the right of the same figure, right, which has the emperor laying in a state of kind of tragic pathos with his young daughter at his feet. It's a very different kind of representation indeed. And the grandeur of the Taj Mahal as well, his great monument, is kind of visually quite small in the distance. So while the painter Tagore himself was not a Muslim, of course, I think the painting nonetheless captures the kind of complex and sort of ambivalent way in which many of his Muslim contemporaries at the time in India thought about the Mughals in particular and approached the political past of Muslim sovereignty in India more broadly. That is, with a kind of great sense of tragedy and loss. The Mughals were sort of paradoxical for Muslims in India at the time because on the one hand, they represented both the height of Muslim political sovereignty in the subcontinent, as well as the loss of that sovereignty to the British. So how does one kind of negotiate and how does one respond to that kind of ambivalent or paradoxical position of the past, right? So 1902 was already quite late. I mentioned that it was sort of the height of colonial rule in India. Colonial rule was already formalized in this context. But there are sort of precedents for this way of thinking about the past and this way of relating to the Mughal past, which can be found a little bit earlier in Muslim thought. And one of the most sort of striking examples of this comes from a somewhat acerbic exchange between two of Delhi's most important intellectuals, the poet Mirza Ghalib on the left here, and the philosopher and writer Syed Ahmad Khan on the right. So Delhi, at the time, was the capital of Mughal India, and both these men were highly respected members of the kind of literati and the intellectual elite of that context, okay? And in the middle of the 19th century, Syed Ahmad Khan, on the right here, had spent sort of several years working on a lengthy scholarly edition of a book called The Ayn-e Akbari, which means the kind of vision of Akbar or the governance of Akbar. And it was a multi-volume book written in Persian, the language of the Mughal court, and it was written in the 16th century. And it was written to document and record the kind of political philosophy of Akbar, who was the third Mughal emperor, and the ruler who oversaw a kind of considerable expansion of territory and centralized and formalized a lot of the administration of the Mughals. So Syed Ahmad Khan's efforts to kind of compile and reprint this book sort of several hundred years later in the context of sort of radical political change indicates not only a kind of reverence for the past, but a sense that its forms of governance, its laws, and its administration might be sort of relevant to the present. So this is a figure in the 19th century editing and printing a book in a kind of new edition a few hundred years after it was first composed as a way of kind of reinvigorating it for the present. So when Syed Ahmed Khan finished work on this book, on the Ayn-e Iqbadi in 1855, he asked his friend, you know, the great poet Mirza Ghalib, to write a taqriz, which was a kind of celebratory foreword in the form of a poem. And these sort of, you know, celebratory forewords were meant to kind of extol the great strengths of the book, kind of praise the author for their efforts and their virtues, and generally act as a kind of nice, you know, pat on the back. Ghalib, however, did not take that route in his composition, and composed a poem that has gone down in history, and some of you may already be familiar with it. And I just wanted to read now a few excerpts of that poem, in translation, of course, to give you a sense of Ghalib's critique, not only of Syed Ahmed Khan, but of the Ayn-e Iqbadi and its significance more broadly. Good news, my friends, this ancient book's door is now open because of the Syed's grace and fortune. The eye began to see, the arm found strength, that which was wrapped in ancient clothes now put on a new dress. And this idea of his, to establish its text and edit the Ayn, puts to shame his exalted capability and potential. In the whole world, this merchandise has no buyer. What profit could my master hope from it? It should be said, it's an excellent inventory, so what's there to see that's worth seeing? Look at the sahibs of England. He's referring, of course, to the British. Look at the style and practice of these. The fire that one brought out of stone, how well these skilled ones bring out from straw. What spell they have struck on water that a vapor drives the boat on water, referring, of course, to steam. Vapor makes the ship speed, making wind and wave redundant. Their instruments make music without the bow. They make words fly high like birds. Oh, don't you see that these wise people get news from thousands of miles in a couple breaths? Go to London, for in that shining garden the city is bright in the night without candles. Look at the business of the knowledgeable ones in every discipline, 100 innovators. When one sees such a treasure house of gems, why should one glean corn from that other harvest? Worshipping the dead is not an auspicious thing, and wouldn't you too think that it's no more than just words? So, the historian of Persian literature and the translator of this poem, Shamsur Rahman Farooqi, writes that Ghalib's taqriz makes the pastness of the past extremely clear. The present and the future are here, and they are in the hands of the innovators, the technologists, the information expediters, and the controllers. He continues, Syed Ahmed Khan never again wrote a word in praise of the Ayn-e Iqbadi, and in fact gave up taking active interest in history and archaeology. And indeed, those of you who are familiar with Syed Ahmed Khan knows that he kind of significantly changes course and in fact is known today primarily as a modernist. And so clearly Ghalib's poem had quite an effect on him. So as you can imagine, Ghalib's harsh words were not well received by Syed Ahmed Khan, who understandably chose not to print the poet's foreword when he finally published the Ayn-e Iqbadi the next year. However, the publication of Syed Ahmed Khan's three-volume edition of the Ayn-e Iqbadi could not have come at a worse time. Though two volumes made it to print, the manuscript of one and the printing press itself were both destroyed during a major war that same year, which is often referred to as the Indian Mutiny, or the Indian Rebellion of 1857. And it was called a mutiny or rebellion only in the eyes of the British, of course, whose Indian soldiers, both Hindu and Muslim, had united in violent resistance against their employers, of course. So the resistance soon spread around the subcontinent, and the British responded with disproportionate and intense violence aimed at suppressing all resistance. Delhi was badly hit, and the last Mughal emperor, Bahadur Shah Zafar, who in any case was a kind of nominal sovereign at that point, was charged and exiled to Rangoon. So the destruction of Delhi and the removal of its kind of symbolic sovereign marked a new phase. It's often said that this is marked a kind of new phase in the British colonial domination of India. putting an official end to any semblance of Muslim sovereignty in the subcontinent. The title of emperor was, of course, transferred to Queen Victoria, who became called the Empress of India, right? So after this moment, the British, but also many Muslims themselves, increasingly invoked the terms of Ghalib's argument, which had claimed that sort of Muslims should just submit to the future, to a future dominated by the technical modernity of the West. This is something that exists in the literature of the time. For the British, this was a clear justification. This kind of trope could justify imperialism. While for Indian Muslims, it helped to make sense of the loss ushered in by colonial rule. And this trope of a present and a future that would be defined by the West and its modernity was often stated alongside another idea, which claimed that Muslims were fated to lag behind Europe and kind of perpetually exist in a state of waiting. So you see these two tropes kind of emerge simultaneously, both amongst the British in this context, but increasingly amongst Muslims themselves, who are taking kind of self-critical inward look. So one of the most important Muslim philosophers of the 20th century, Muhammad Iqbal, concerned himself with precisely these questions. Were Indian Muslims destined to live in the past? What determined their attitude towards time and movement? Was there any intellectual weight to the common British claim that Islam was destined to sort of lag behind European modernity? These are the kinds of questions that Iqbal was interested in. And those of you who are already familiar with Iqbal may know him as primarily a political thinker who is often called the kind of spiritual father of Pakistan, even though he died sort of a decade before it was founded. Iqbal was well versed in both Eastern and Western philosophy, beginning his studies in a region of India known as the Punjab, and then continuing on to Cambridge, where he was exposed to new avenues of science like quantum physics, and Munich, where he learned about the philosophy of the German idealists. By the time he returned to India in the early 20th century, he had a solid grounding not only in the kind of dense philosophical traditions of India and the Islamic world, but in the European philosophical tradition as well. So Iqbal took what we might call a kind of comparative approach to philosophy, which is especially evident in a series of lectures he delivered in the 1930s called The Reconstruction of Religious Thought in Islam. And you can see them sort of printed here. They were printed in 1934. In these lectures, Iqbal argued that the dominant conception of time that existed, especially in Europe, was called serial time. So this understanding, which had recently found expression in Einstein's theory of time as a kind of another dimension, was essentially, Iqbal thought, a spatial conception of time. Okay? It was often conceived of as a straight line composed of different spatial points which are external to each other, like different points on a journey. This dominant understanding of time, for Iqbal, relied on processes of quantification and measurement, and ultimately was compelled to split time into past, present, and future. For Iqbal, time conceived of in this way was always and already preconceived. It was a kind of fatalistic attitude towards time, and so could never really become what he called a genuine creative movement. For, quote, what we call future events are not fresh happenings, but things already given and located in an unknown space. So another way of stating this is that events do not happen, we simply arrive at them. So a productive link made by Iqbal himself was with Nietzsche, the German philosopher, his notion of the eternal recurrence or the eternal return. And this assumed the kind of infinite repetition and thus pre-existence of all events in time. And this was, in Iqbal's view, the kind of logical and ultimately debilitating conclusion to serial time, to kind of living with serial time. Because it sort of foreclose the possibility of movement and change in the present, either by sort of chaining it up to the past and seeing everything as an effect of the past, or tying it to a sort of deferred future towards which one could only arrive. So it made the present kind of ineffable. It made the present kind of difficult to actually grasp. And Iqbal wrote that in this vision, in this way of seeing time, the absolutely new is kind of unthinkable. It's literally inconceivable. So Iqbal juxtaposed this understanding of serial time, which he thought was the dominant kind of experience of time, as well as the understanding of time that could be derived from European political philosophy, with true or pure time, which he thought captured the inner life and consciousness in particular in a way that serial time never really could. Seeking pure time was, for Iqbal, emancipatory, and so necessary for Muslims to be truly free. For Iqbal, pure time was this kind of ineffable and invisible condition in which states of consciousness could melt into each other, and the false distinctions between past, present, and future, along with the gaps that defined them, like anticipation or waiting, were collapsed, so that there is no numerical distinctness of states. So in one remark, Iqbal says that serial time kind of pulverizes the now into a series of beads, like a series of pearl beads on a thread, while pure time allows one to experience the now in its kind of full sense. So Iqbal sometimes referred to an arcane idea from the Quran called Barzakh to illustrate this conception of time. So it's usually translated as a kind of barrier or a partition, but it's commonly understood as the kind of liminal space between death and resurrection. And Barzakh for Iqbal represented the potential to escape the spatial character of serial time. The state of Barzakh, Iqbal claimed, does not seem to be merely a passive state of expectation. It is a fresh state in which the self catches a glimpse of fresh aspects of reality and prepares himself for adjustment to these aspects. So, in the context of colonial India and amidst the common accusations that Muslims were stagnant and Islam was static, and of a future that was kind of predetermined by European hegemony, Iqbal's ideas were both radical and potent, as I'm sure you can see. He argued that a truly emancipatory philosophy of time would actually need to reject the spatial or linear understanding of time that was dominant not only amongst the British, but amongst Muslim thinkers as well. And that would only lead, that kind of spatial understanding would only lead to feelings of futility and aimlessness. History for Iqbal was a genuinely creative movement, not something that should be replicated or repeated or held onto for the sake of nostalgia. So you may be wondering now how these ideas relate to the Mughal past or the themes with which I began my talk. And at this point, I want to say that Iqbal was a philosopher but also a poet. And in fact, he is remembered today across South Asia primarily for his poetry, and in other parts of the world as well. He wrote poetry in Urdu and in Persian. So his writings are not really read or recited as much as his poetry. And this poetry contains sort of deep philosophical ideas and is still performed and recited today. And Iqbal explored the relationship between serial and pure time throughout his poetry. But today I want to look at how that relationship unfolded in a two-part poem that he composed over a few years, Shikwa and Jawab-e-Shikwa. So Shikwa means complaint, and Iqbal wrote this long poem as a complaint addressed to God in 1911. It compiled a set of grievances from the perspective of humanity who felt let down by God and from and Muslims in particular, whose fate in the 20th century was defined by loss and colonial rule. So Iqbal wanted to kind of channel those feelings of loss and sort of disappointment into a poem, which he called Shikwa, addressed to God. And one of the main themes of Shikwa has to do with an orientation towards time, actually. So why shouldn't humanity, the poem states, focus on the material rewards of the future? Why should it not simply abandon the past, which has no use anymore? So Shikwa actually begins with the following verse. Why should I forever lose and forget what I seek to gain? Should I not think of tomorrow, or shall I stay absorbed in the grief of yesterday? Why should my ears remain impervious to the nightingale's lament? Friend, I am only a hard-hearted rose. Am I only a hard-hearted rose that should remain silent? My faculty of speech has given me a strange new courage. May dust be in my mouth, against God I make a complaint. So here, the kind of theme that's coming out is, why should I not sacrifice the present or the past for the future? Why should I not be oriented towards a future time? Why should I not sort of pursue that futurity without any disregard for the present? So, as you can imagine, this poem stirred quite a bit of controversy when it was first recited, especially amongst more conservative circles, who accused Iqbal of arrogance and heresy for daring to file a complaint against God, even if it was a literary one. Rather than back down, a few years later, Iqbal seems to have gone even further and composed an answer to the complaint from the perspective of God, called Jawab-e-Shikwa. And before I read from the answer, I think it's worth playing a contemporary rendition of this verse, of the complaint, recited by Pakistani musicians Ustad Farid Ayaz and Ustad Abu Muhammad, so that you can get a sense of how the poem is recited and the kind of emotive power of the language. For those of you who want to watch the rest of the video, the link, I think, is going to be shared with you. It does continue on to sing parts of this verse as well. And you can kind of see obviously the translation into English doesn't capture kind of the emotive quality of the kind of audacity of filing that complaint, right? This is something that I think is captured really, really well in that recitation. As the musicians noted, Iqbal was criticized for speaking as a man, as a human, but praised when he wrote Jawab-e-Shikwa, or the answer to the complaint, partly because it reprimanded humanity for not living up to its purpose. So this is, the answer to the complaint kind of poses a sort of counterpoint. And it sort of argues that humanity did not live up to the greatness of its forefathers and previous generations of Muslims, and accuses Muslims of kind of sitting idly and waiting, idly and waiting in a kind of passive state of expectation for destiny to come and redeem them, rather than renewing their spiritual relationship with the past and searching for pure time. So I'll just read from some excerpts from the Jawab-e-Shikwa right now. These were your forebears and ancestors, but who are you? With hands folded, you sit and wait for a better day. Some of you are Sayyids, you are Mirzas, you are Afghans, you are everything, but tell me, are you a Muslim too? You have inherited neither the past's great austerity nor its great wealth. What spiritual relationship do you have with your ancestors? You are violent among yourselves while they were merciful. You only reveal faults while they concealed them. The new age is like lightning, starting a fire on every harvest. Neither any desert nor any garden is safe from it. For this new fire, ancient communities are the fuel. The community of the Prophet is consumed in its fire. So read together, Iqbal's philosophy of time conveyed through the lectures on the Reconstruction and through the two poems does not kind of argue for a complete annihilation of the past in favor of the future, but it also does not advocate kind of clinging to or imitating the past uncritically. It argues instead for a kind of emancipatory renewal and a relationship to history that allows us to think of the present differently from simply an inevitability. So it pushes the individual to kind of extract themselves from serial time in order to, precisely in order to be creative. And I want to conclude my talk now with another painting, which is a contemporary artwork. And it's in the same tradition, the same artistic tradition, the miniature tradition that I began with. But this time it's from a contemporary period and by a Pakistani-American artist named Shazia Sikandar. Like the two paintings I began with, this one is also about the loss of sovereignty to some extent because it displays an empty throne, you can see right here, referencing a way of depicting rulers and princes such as this painting about the ascension of King Solomon, who was flanked by angels upon his ascension. And Shazia was referring to this when she made this artwork. So in the painting on the left, Sikandar kind of acknowledges the removal of sovereignty, the loss of sovereignty indicated by the emptied out throne, right? But she does so without any nostalgia or a sense of kind of pathos and lament. Like the painting from a century earlier. This is painted almost exactly 100 years after the passing of Shah Jahan. This work is called Sly Offering, and it instead presents two female figures, one sort of a recognizable Indian figure who may refer to the present, perhaps, and one more ambiguous one who could refer to the Greek or the ancient past, both of whom share or maybe compete for that emptied out throne, that seat of power, but neither of whom seem to be in full control of it. You can see how the figure on the left is sort of extending a flower to the figure on the right. The materials used in the work also make reference to a kind of blurring of different times and technologies. You have watercolor on tea-stained paper, more traditional mediums, as well as inkjet printing, all melting into each other, as it were. And so I'll leave it there and I think take questions now. So thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the AKC podcast. If you have enjoyed this lecture, please click subscribe in your podcast app to receive future episodes. AKC, at the heart of King's thinking.